If it were me, Lila said, I'd begin with a boyfriend. Andy Fisher? He was the last person to see her alive. What would we ask him? You keep saying we, Lila said, an incredulous smile crossing her face. There is no we. This is your firing squad. I don't know if you picked up on this, but you're the smart one here, I joked. So that would make you the pretty one? She said. No, you're that one too, I said, watching for her reaction. A smile, maybe a wink, some sign that she heard my compliment. Nothing. I'd been dancing around Lila ever since I first saw her in the hallway, trying to get past the wall she had put up, the wall that kept me at arm's length, the one she tore down for Jeremy the first day they met. I wanted to see her laugh and have fun with me like she did with Jeremy, but all my subtle compliments and attempts at humor fizzled like wet firecrackers. I had been contemplating a more direct approach, one that would ensure a response one way or another. I was going to ask Lila out on a date. As I joked about her being pretty, it dawned on me that now would be as good a time as any. I stood and walked to the kitchen, having no reason to do so other than to execute a cowardly delay tactic. Once I had a little distance between us, I stumbled into my speech. You know, I've been thinking. I mean, I think we should go out. I blurted it out, catching her by surprise. Her lips parting as if to speak, then pausing, as if she was unsure of what to say. Like, on a date? She said. We don't have to call it a date. Joe, I'm not... She looked down at the coffee table, her shoulders slumping forward, her fingers picking at the material of her sweatpants. This was supposed to be just a spaghetti dinner, remember? Nothing more than that. We can go to an Italian restaurant. It'll still be just a spaghetti dinner. Silence filled the room. I noticed that I was holding my breath as I waited for Lila to respond. Finally, she looked at me and said, I can get extra credit if I go see a play for my American Lit class. It's playing the weekend of Thanksgiving. I can get 2 tickets for that Friday. This is not a date, it's just extra credit. That's the deal. Are you okay with that? I love plays, I said. In truth, I had never actually seen a play other than the skits and vignettes that the drama club put on at the pep rallies back in high school. What's the play called? The Glass Menagerie, she said. Great, I said. It's a date. I mean, it's not a date. Chapter 25. We found Andy Fisher through an alumni directory on his high school's Facebook page. Andy, who now went by the more adult name of Andrew, had inherited an insurance agency from his father, operating an office in a strip mall on the east side of Golden Valley, Minnesota. Andrew Fisher had not aged well. His boyish locks were gone, replaced by a monk-like bald spot that covered most of his crown, spreading from the back of his head to the front, leaving a thin wisp of hair that curved along the top of his forehead like an old picket fence. His waistline bulged against an overworked leather belt, and dark lines formed permanent crescents under his eyes. He sat in a cheaply paneled office, its walls lined with undersized hunting and fishing trophies. When we walked in, Andrew came into the empty reception area to greet us, his hand thrust out in front of him to shake mine. What can I do for you? He said, with the gusto of a salesman. No, wait, let me guess. He glanced out the plate glass window at my rusted Accord and smiled. You're looking to buy a new car and need an insurance quote. Actually, I said, we were hoping you'd talk to us about Crystal Hagen. Crystal Hagen? The smile vanished from his face. Who are you? I'm Joe Talbert. I'm a student at the U, and this is, I'm his classmate, Lila, she said. I continued. We're doing a story on Crystal's death. Why? He said. That was so long ago. He looked almost sad for a moment. Then he shook the memories away. I've put that all behind me. I don't like talking about it. It's important, I said. How can it be important? He said. It's ancient history. They caught the guy, Carl Iverson. He lived next door to her. Now I think you should leave. He turned his back on us and started walking into his office. What if we told you that we think Carl Iverson might be innocent? Lila said, blurting out the words without any forethought. We glanced at each other, and she shrugged. Fisher stopped in the doorway to his office, took a deep breath, but didn't turn toward us. "All we want is a little bit of your time," I said. "Why won't this ever go away?" Andrew whispered to himself as he walked the rest of the way into his office. We didn't leave. He sat at his desk, surrounded by dead animal heads, not making eye contact with us. We waited. Then, without looking up, he lifted two fingers and waved us in. We entered and sat in the client chairs across the desk from him, not sure how to begin the conversation. Then he spoke. "I still have nights when I see her in my dreams, the way she was back then. Sweet. Young. Then the dreams turned dark, and we're at the cemetery. She's sinking into the ground and calling my name. That's when I wake up in a cold sweat." "She calls your name?" I said. "Why? You didn't do anything wrong, did you?" He looked at me coldly. "That case messed up my life." I know I should have been more sympathetic, but to hear this guy moan, "Poor me," kind of rubbed me the wrong way. "It kind of messed up Crystal Hagen's life, too," I said. "Don't you think?" "Son?" Andrew held up his finger and thumb to mark an inch. "You're about this close to getting your butt kicked out of here." "That must have been a terrible time for you," Lila interrupted, speaking in a comforting tone, cognizant that honey will better attract the bear. "I was 16 years old," Andrew said. "It didn't matter that I didn't do anything wrong. People treated me like a leper. Even though they arrested that Iverson guy, there were all these rumors floating around that I killed her." The muscles in Andrew's jaw twitched as a flash of emotion passed through his cheeks. "The day they buried her, I went to toss a handful of dirt on the coffin after they lowered her casket down. Her mother shot me a cold stare that froze me in my tracks, like Crystal's death was my fault." The corners of Andrew's mouth dipped down as if he were going to start crying. He took a moment to gather himself. "I've never forgotten that look. The accusation in her eyes, it's what I remember most when I think about the day we buried Crystal." "So people thought you killed Crystal," I said. "People are idiots," he said. "Besides, if I was going to kill anybody, it would have been that damn defense lawyer." "The defense lawyer?" I said. "He's the one who fed the rumor that I killed her. He told the jury that I did it, that son of a bitch. It was in the papers. I was 16, for God's sake." "You were the last one to see her alive," I said. Andrew narrowed his gaze at me, and for a second, I thought I had blown it. "We read the trial testimony," I added. "Then you know that I dropped her off at her home and drove away," he said. "She was alive when I left." "That's right," Lila said. "You dropped her off, and if I recall, you said she was home alone."
"I never said she was alone. I said I didn't think anyone else was home. There's a difference. The place seemed empty to me, that's all."
"Do you know who her stepfather was?" Lila asked. "Or her stepbrother?"
"Now how would I know that?" he said.
Lila looked at her notes, pretending to refresh her memory. "Well, according to Doug Lockwood's testimony, that's Crystal's stepfather, he and Danny were at his used car dealership when Crystal was being murdered."
"That sounds right," he said. "The old man ran a used car lot. He licensed Crystal's mom and Danny both as dealers so that they could drive any car on the lot. All they had to do was put dealer plates on the car."
"Danny was a dealer too?"
"Only on paper. As soon as he turned 18, he got his dealer's license. He was one of those kids on the cusp. His birthday was near that cutoff where he could either be the youngest kid in his class or they could hold him back a year and he'd be the oldest kid in his class. They held him back."
Andrew leaned back in his chair.
"Personally, I always thought Danny was an ass."
"Why?"
I asked. "Well, to begin with, that family argued a lot. Crystal's mom and stepdad were constantly yelling at each other, and it was usually about Danny. Danny didn't like his dad marrying Crystal's mom. The way Crystal told it, Danny treated her mom like shit. Kind of went out of his way to cause fights. And then there were the cars."
"Cars?"
Lila asked. "Because Danny's old man ran that car lot, Danny got to pick any car on the lot to drive to school. When Danny was a senior, his dad flat out gave him a car, this cherry Grand Prix, as an early Christmas present. It was a great car, but I mean, it's one thing to act cool in a car you bought and fixed up yourself, because that says something about you. It's your car. You earned it.
but he drove around like he was hot shit in a car that his daddy gave him. I don't know. He was just an ass that way.
What was the stepdad like?
Lila asked. A real wingnut, Andrew said. He used to act all religious, but it seemed to me that he used the Bible to back any argument he wanted to make. There was this one time when Crystal's mom found out that the old man had been visiting a strip club. He tells her about how Jesus hung out with prostitutes and tax collectors, like that made it okay for him to be tucking dollar bills into G-strings.
How did he and Crystal get along? I asked.
Andrew gave a polite shudder, like he just bit into an undercooked trout.
She hated him, he said.
He used to belittle her using lines from the Bible. Most of the time she had no idea what he was saying. One time he told her that she should be thankful that he was not Jephthah. We looked that one up.
Jephthah? That's from the Bible?
Yeah, from the book of Judges. He sacrificed his daughter to God so that he could win a battle.
I mean, who the hell says stuff like that to a teenaged girl?
Did you ever talk to Danny or to Doug about what happened that day?
Lila asked.
I never talked to anyone about it.
I gave a statement to the cops, and then I tried to pretend it didn't happen. I didn't talk about it again until the trial.
Did you watch the trial?
I asked. No, I did my testimony and left.
He looked down at the desk, the way Jeremy looks away from me when he doesn't want to answer a question.
You didn't go back to watch any of it?
I pressed.
I saw the closing arguments, he said. I skipped school to watch the end of the trial. I thought the jury would have a verdict right away like they do on TV.
I tried to remember if I'd read the closing argument in the transcript. I assume the prosecutor talked about Crystal's diary in his closing.
The blood suddenly drained from Andrew's cheeks, his face turning the color of plumber's putty.
I remember the diary,
he said, his voice now lowered to a whisper.
I didn't even know Crystal kept a diary until that day when the prosecutor summed everything up for the jury.
The prosecutor argued that Mr. Iverson was making Crystal do things to him, sexually, because he caught you two, you know.
I remember, Andrew said.
Did Crystal ever talk to you about that?
I asked.
About getting caught, or Mr. Iverson threatening her?
I mean, that never made much sense to me. The prosecutor went on and on about it. The jury bought it, but you were there. Is that what happened?
Andrew leaned forward, rubbing his palms into his eyes, his fingers extending up to his bald head.
He slowly dragged his fingers down his face, over his eyes, down his cheeks. Then he folded them together to form a steeple on his lips. He looked back and forth between Lila and me, contemplating whether to tell us what weighed so heavily on his mind.
"Remember me telling you about waking up in cold sweats?"
he said finally.
"Yeah,"
I said.
"It's because of that diary,"
he said.
"The prosecutor got it wrong. He got it all wrong."
Lila leaned forward.
"Tell us,"
she said in a sweet, consoling voice, coaxing Andrew to unburden his soul.
"I didn't think it was important. I mean, it shouldn't have been important. I didn't know until I went to the trial and watched the closing argument what they said about Mr. Iverson catching us. Crystal and me..."
Andrew stopped talking. He was still looking in our direction, but he averted his eyes as if he was ashamed of whatever secret he had been keeping.
"What about Crystal and you?"
Lila said.
"It's true," Andrew said. "He did catch us. Crystal was creeped out by it. But at the trial, the prosecutor made such a big deal out of it, saying that Crystal thought her life would be ruined because of us getting caught having... Well, you know. He told the jury that she made a diary entry on September 21st, saying that she was having a very bad day. He said she was freaking out because Mr. Iverson was blackmailing her or something. That entry had nothing to do with us getting caught having sex."
"How do you know that?"
I asked.
"The 21st of September was my mother's birthday.
Crystal called me that night. She wanted me to meet her. I didn't. I couldn't. We were having a party for my mom's birthday. Crystal was going out of her mind."
"Crystal told you why she was freaking out?"
I asked.
"Yes."
Andrew stopped talking, turned his chair around, pulled a tumbler and a small bottle of scotch out of the buffet behind him, poured three fingers of liquor into the glass, and drank half of it. Then he put the glass and bottle down on his desk, folded his hands together, and continued.
Crystal's stepdad had some really great cars on his lot, one in particular. A 1970 Pontiac GTO, bronze, with a spoiler on the back. It was a beautiful car. He took another drink of his scotch. One night, around the middle of September, Crystal and me were talking about that car. I was telling her how I wished I could drive a car like that, how unfair my life was. You know, normal high school stuff. And she says that we should take the GTO for a ride. She knew where her stepdad kept the spare keys to the office and where the car keys were kept in the office. All we had to do was return everything to where it was. So we take my crappy Ford Galaxy 500 to her stepdad's lot, and it was just like she said. We found the keys to the GTO and took it for a spin. "You were a sophomore?" Lila said. "Yeah. I'm also one of those cusp babies, like Danny. I got my license that August after I turned 16. "Car theft?" I said. "That's what she was upset about?" "It gets worse," he said. He took another deep breath, letting it go with a sigh. "Like I said, I only had my license for about a month, and I never drove a car with that much power. I couldn't help racing from stoplight to stoplight. We were having a great time until..." He finished his drink, licking the last few drops from his lips. "I was flying down Central Avenue, probably doing 70 miles an hour. God, I was stupid. The tire blew out. I tried to hold it together, but we crossed lanes and skidded into the side of a car. A police squad car, empty, parked in front of a deli. Later I read in the paper that the cops were in the back of the deli dealing with a break-in, so they had no idea we smashed into their car." "Did anyone get hurt?" Lila asked. "We weren't wearing seatbelts," Andrew said. "We both hit pretty hard. I bruised my chest on the steering wheel, and Crystal went face first into the dashboard. She broke her glasses." "Glasses?" I said. "Crystal wore glasses? I saw the trial pictures. She wasn't wearing glasses." "She usually wore her contacts, but sometimes her eyes would get irritated, and then she wore her glasses instead. And that's the terrible thing that freaked her out. One of her lenses popped out in the accident. We didn't realize it until later. She just grabbed her glasses from the floor after the accident, and we ran as fast as we could. By the time we realized the lens was gone, it was too late to go back. It took us about an hour to walk back to my car. I came up with an idea to break a window at the car lot to make it look like someone broke in and stole the keys to the GTO. The next day, the story was on the radio and on the TV. It was a big deal because we had a cop car." "That's what Crystal was freaking out about?" I said. "They found her lens?" "Not just that," Andrew said. "Crystal hid the broken eyeglasses. We were going to buy her a new pair, and we wanted to make sure that we got identical frames. But that day when she called me up, my mom's birthday, Crystal said that her eyeglasses were missing. She thought somebody found the proof that we sold the car and did a hit and run. That's why she was freaking out." "Where'd she hide them? Home? School?" "I honestly don't know. She never said. She got weird after that, sad and distant. She didn't seem to want to be around me." He paused to take another breath, to calm the emotions swelling up in his chest. "I didn't realize until I heard the closing argument, until I heard the words from her diary, that she was being... well, you know." "And you didn't mention to anybody about the diary being misread?" Lila said. "No." Andrew lowered his eyes. "Why didn't you tell his attorney?" I said. "That prick dragged my name through the mud. I'd just as soon spit on him than talk to him. You can't imagine what it was like to open a newspaper to see some defense attorney accusing you of raping and murdering your girlfriend. I had to go to therapy because of that bastard. Besides, I lettered in 3 sports in high school. I was good enough to get a baseball scholarship to Mankato State. If I had told anyone about stealing that car, I would have been arrested, suspended from school, kicked out of sports. I would have lost everything. That whole thing fucked me up pretty bad." "Fucked you up?" I said, my anger bubbling through. "So let me get this straight. Rather than ruin your letter jacket, you let the jury believe a lie." "There was a ton of evidence against that Iverson guy," Andrew said. "What did it matter if they misunderstood the diary? I wasn't going to stick my neck out for him. He killed my girlfriend, didn't he?" Andrew looked back and forth between Lila and me. waiting for one of us to answer. We didn't say a word. We watched as he swallowed the dust from his tongue. We waited as his words echoed off the walls and came back to him, tapping his shoulder like Poe's telltale heart. Lila and I waited, saying nothing, until he finally looked down at the top of his desk and said, "I should have told someone. I know that. I've always known that. I guess I was waiting for the right time to get this off my chest. I thought I might forget about it someday, but I didn't. I couldn't. Like I said, I still have nightmares." Chapter 26. On television, people dressed in nice clothes when they attended the theater, but I didn't have any nice clothes. I'd moved to college with a single duffel bag filled with jeans, shorts, and shirts, mostly collarless. So I did a pilgrimage to a second-hand store the week of the play, finding khakis and a button-down shirt to wear. I also found a pair of deck shoes, but the seam above the big toe on the right foot was torn. I poked a paperclip through the holes where the stitching had been and sealed the tear, twisting off the excess. By 6:30 I was ready to go, although I couldn't get my palms to stop sweating. When Lila opened her door, I was astonished. A red sweater hugged her torso and waistline, showing off curves I didn't know she had, and a shiny black skirt squeezed her hips, sliding down her thighs as smooth as melting chocolate. She wore makeup, which I'd never seen her do before, her cheeks, her lips, her eyes all quietly demanding my attention. It was like washing the dust off a window you didn't realize was dirty. I fought to keep from grinning. I wanted to grab her and squeeze her and kiss her. More than anything else, I wanted to spend time with her, walking and talking and watching a play. "Well, don't you look nice?" she said. "Back at you," I smiled, pleased that my hand-me-downs had passed muster. "Shall we?" I said, motioning down the hall. It was a beautiful night for a walk, at least for Minnesota in late November. 40 degrees, clear, no wind, no rain, no sleet, no snow, which was a good thing, since it was a 10-block walk to the Rarig Center for the play. Our path took us across Northrop Mall, the oldest and grandest parts of campus, and then across the footbridge that spanned the Mississippi River. Most of the students had gone home for the Thanksgiving break. I thought about going home to see Jeremy, but the downside always seemed to outweigh the upside. I had asked Lila why she wasn't going home for the holiday. She simply shook her head and didn't answer. Even I knew that meant to leave it alone. Besides, I chose to look at the positive. With the campus so empty, it made our walk seem all the more private, more like a date. I walked with my hands in my coat pocket, my elbow cocked out to the side just in case Lila decided to link her arm with mine. She didn't. I didn't know a thing about the glass menagerie before that night. If I had, I might not have gone, even if that would have meant missing out on my date with Lila. In the very first scene, this fellow named Tom walked onto the stage and started talking to us. Our seats were right in the middle of the theater, and he seemed to pick me as a focal point for his attention from the get-go. At first, I thought that was cool, this actor saying his lines as though he was talking to me personally. As the play progressed, we met his sister, Laura, whose debilitating introversion seemed oddly familiar to me, and his mother, Amanda, who lived in a fantasy world waiting for some outside savior, a gentleman caller, to arrive and save them from themselves. I felt the trickle of sweat beat on my chest as visions of my own screwed-up little family moved on that stage. As the first act came to an end, I heard my mother on stage, as Amanda, chastising Tom, saying, "Self, self, self, is that all you ever think of?" I could see Tom pacing in his cage, the apartment, trapped there by his affection for his sister. The theater grew warmer with each line. At intermission, I needed to get some water, so Lila and I walked to the lobby. "Well, what do you think about the play so far?" she asked. I felt a little sick in my chest, but I smiled politely. "It's marvelous," I said. "I don't know how they do it, memorizing all those lines. I could never be an actor." "There's more to it than just memorizing lines," she said. "Don't you love the way they pull you in, make you feel the emotions?" I took another drink of water. "It's amazing," I said. I had a lot more to say about that, but I kept those thoughts to myself. As the lights went down for the second act, I put my hand on the armrest between us, my palm up, hoping that she might want to hold it. forlorn hope at best.
In the play, the gentleman callers showed up, and I held out hope for a happy ending. I was wrong. Everything fell apart. It turned out that the gentleman caller was already engaged to marry another woman. The stage erupted in anger and recrimination, and Laura retreated back to her world of tiny glass figurines, her glass menagerie. The actor playing Tom walked to the front of the stage, pulled the collar of his peacoat up around his neck, lit a cigarette, and told the audience how he left St. Louis, leaving his mother and sister behind. I felt my throat and chest tighten, and my breath stumble. Tears began to well up in my eyes. "These are just actors," I told myself. "It's just a guy saying lines that he memorized, that's all." Tom lamented about how he still hears Laura's voice and sees her face in the colored glass of perfume bottles. As he spoke, I could see Jeremy looking out the front window at me the last time I drove away, not moving, not waving goodbye, his eyes accusing me, begging me not to leave. Then the son of a bitch on stage looked directly at me and said, "Laura, I tried to leave you behind me, but I am more faithful than I intended to be." I couldn't stop the tears from falling down my face. I didn't raise my hand to wipe them away. That would have drawn attention to my state. So I let them fall, unfettered. That's when I felt Lila's hand gently wrap into my fingers. I didn't look at her. I couldn't. She didn't look at me either. She just held my hand until the man on stage stopped talking and the pain in my chest subsided. Chapter 27. After the play, Lila and I walked to Seven Corners, a hub of taverns and eateries on the west bank of campus, named for a particularly confusing cluster of intersections. On the way there, I told her about my trip to Austin, about leaving Jeremy with my mother and Larry, and about the bruise on Jeremy's back and the blood on Larry's nose. I felt that I needed to explain why the play messed me up the way it did. Lila said, "Do you think Jeremy's safe?" "I don't know," I said. But I think I did know. That was the problem. That was the reason the last scene of the play tore me up the way it did. "Was I wrong to leave home?" I asked. "Was I wrong to go to school?" Lila didn't answer. "I mean, I can't stay home forever. No one can ask me to do that. I have a right to live my own life, don't I?" "You are his brother," she said. "Like it or not, that means something." That wasn't what I wanted to hear. "Does it mean I have to give up college and everything I want in my life?" "We all have our own baggage to deal with," she said. "Nobody gets through life unscathed." "That's easy for you to say," I said. She stopped walking and looked at me with an intensity normally reserved for a lover's quarrel. "That's not easy for me to say," she said. "That's not easy at all." She turned and started walking again, her cheeks getting rosy from the November chill. A cold front was on its way, one that would usher in the deep freeze of winter. We walked on in silence for a while, and then she linked her arm through mine and gave my arm a squeeze. I think it was her way of telling me that she wanted to change the subject, which was fine with me. We found a bar with a few open tables and music playing at a decibel level that would allow us to talk. I scanned the room, looking for the quietest table, and found a booth for us, far from the noise. After we sat, I dug around for a topic of small talk. "So, are you a junior?" I asked. "No, I'm only a sophomore," she said. "But you are 21, right?" "I took a year off before coming to college," she said. The waitress came by to get our drink order. I ordered a Jack and Coke, and Lila ordered a 7-Up. "Oh, you're hitting the hard stuff, are you?" I said. "I don't drink," Lila said. "I used to, but not anymore. I feel kind of strange drinking alone." "I'm not a temperance chick," she said. "I have nothing against drinking, it's just a choice I made." As the waitress set our drinks on the table, a loud roar erupted from the corner of the bar, where a tableful of drunks were competing with one another to be heard in some inane debate about football. The waitress rolled her eyes. I looked over my shoulder at the group of guys pushing and jostling in that good-natured way that so often turns into a brawl after one too many drinks. The bouncer at the door had his eye on them as well. I settled back down into my booth. After the waitress left, Lila and I launched into a discussion of the play, with Lila doing most of the talking. She was a big fan of Tennessee Williams. I sip my drink and listen to Lila talk, and then laugh. I had never seen her so animated, so passionate about anything. Her words rose and purled in a graceful arabesque, and then kicked with jazz. I hadn't realized how lost I had become in our conversation until Lila abruptly stopped talking in mid-sentence, her eyes fixed on something over my left shoulder. Whatever it was, it had stunned her into silence.
"Oh, my God,"
came a voice from behind me.
"It's Nasty Nash."
I turned to see one of the guys from the loud table standing a few feet from our booth, his left hand holding a beer that shook as he teetered. He pointed at Lila with his other hand, and in a booming voice called her out,
"Nasty Nash, I don't fucking believe it. Remember me?"
Lila's face had gone pale, her breathing shallow. She stared at her glass, which she held with trembling fingertips.
"Huh? Don't remember? Maybe this will help."
He put a hand down in front of his crotch area, his palm turned down as if he were holding a bowling ball. Then he started pumping his hips. He screwed his face up, biting his lower lip, tipping his head back.
"Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, doing the nasty."
Lila began to shake, whether with rage or fear, I couldn't tell.
"What do you say we take a trip down memory lane?"
the slob said, looking at me and smiling.
"I don't mind sharing. Just ask her."
Lila stood and ran from the bar. I didn't know whether to chase after her or give her some space. That's when the slob spoke again, this time to me.
"You better get her, dude. She's a sure thing."
I felt my right hand tighten into a fist. Then I relaxed it. When I first started working at the Piedmont Club, a fellow bouncer named Ronnie Gant showed me a move that he called Ronnie's Rope-a-Dope, which, like a magician's illusion, relied upon misdirection. I rose from my seat, looked at the slob, and smiled a big, hearty smile. He was three steps away from me. I walked toward him, taking my three steps at a casual pace, just a couple guys saying hello, my arms outstretched in a friendly gesture. He smiled back, as if we were sharing an inside joke. Get him to drop his guard. I gave him a thumbs up on my second step, joining him in a laugh, my smile disarming him, distracting him. He was taller than me by 3 or 4 inches, and he probably outweighed me by 40 pounds, which he stored mostly in his ample gut. I kept his eyes focused on my face, his beer-addled brain focused on our apparent connection. He didn't see my right hand slink down to my waist, cocked at the elbow. With my third step, I invaded his personal space, planting my right foot squarely between his feet. I shot my left hand up under the slob's right armpit, grabbed the shirt behind his shoulder blade, cocked my right arm, and jammed my fist into his stomach with all the force I could muster. My punch landed in that soft catfish belly that every man has just below his ribcage. I hit him so hard that I could feel his rib bones wrap around my knuckles. The breath shot from his chest, his lungs exploding like a balloon. He wanted to double over, but I clutched his shirt and shoulder blade with my left hand and pulled him into me. His knees started to buckle, and I could hear the squeaking of his lungs as they fought for air. The key to Ronnie's rope-a-dope was subtlety. If I had clocked him in the jaw, he would have fallen back, making a huge fuss. His buddies at the loud table would have been on me in a flash. A couple of his friends were already watching me, but to an outsider, I looked like a good Samaritan helping a drunk to a seat. I walked the slob to the booth where Lila and I had been sitting, and plopped him down just in time to watch him puke. His two friends started making their way toward their buddy. The bouncer also took notice of me. I mimed the international sign for drinking too much, thumb and pinky stretched out to simulate the handle of a beer stein, and a wave up and down with the thumb near the lips. The bouncer nodded and started over to deal with the vomiting drunk. I wiped my sweaty palms across the thighs of my pants and walked out the door calmly and orderly, as if I had become bored with the evening. Once outside, I started running. The slob would soon be breathing enough to tell his friends what happened. They would, no doubt, come after me in numbers far from fair. I headed for the Washington Avenue footbridge that connected the west bank of campus to the east bank. Before I could turn a corner, two guys came out of the bar and saw me. I had about a one-block head start. One of the guys was built like an offensive tackle, big and powerful, and slow as mud. His friend, however, had some legs, a tight end maybe, or a linebacker in high school. He might be trouble. He screamed something that I couldn't make out over the whistling of wind and pounding of blood in my ears. I saw right away that I wouldn't make it across the footbridge. The tight end would catch me in that long straightaway for sure. Besides, Lila would be on the footbridge by now. If they saw her in the bar, they might recognize her and go after her instead. I ran for a cluster of buildings around Wilson Library, reaching the first building, the Humphrey Center, with only a couple hundred feet between me and the tight end. I had been holding back just a bit as I ran, letting him think I could only run so fast. When I turned the first corner, I poured it on, twisting and twining around every building I came to, around Heller Hall, then Blagan Hall, then around the Social Sciences Building and Wilson Library. By the time I made my second pass around the Social Sciences Building, I could no longer see the tight end behind me, nor hear his footsteps. I found a parking lot and ducked behind a pickup truck to wait, my lungs heaving and burning as they shoveled oxygen in and out. I lay on the asphalt to breathe and recover from my escape, peering under the truck across the mostly empty parking lot and watching for my pursuers. After 10 minutes, I saw the tight end about a block away, walking up 19th Avenue, making his way back towards Seven Corners and the bar. When he had gone, I took a deep breath, stood, and brushed the dirt and grit from my body, and headed for the footbridge in Lila's apartment, where, hopefully, she would be waiting for me. Chapter 28. I could see a dim light falling from Lila's apartment as I approached the building. I paused on the front stoop to collect myself and catch my breath after my jog home. Then I walked up the narrow staircase and down the hall to knock gently on Lila's door. No answer. "Lila," I said through the door. "It's me, Joe." Still nothing. I knocked again, and this time heard the unmistakable click of the deadbolt being turned back. I waited for the door to open, but it didn't. So I opened the door a few inches and saw Lila sitting sideways on her couch, her back to me and her knees tucked up to her chest. She had changed out of the sweater and skirt and into a gray sweatshirt and matching sweatpants. I stepped inside her apartment, carefully closing the door behind me. "You okay?" I asked. She didn't answer. I walked to the couch and sat behind her, putting one hand on the back of the couch, my other hand gently touching her shoulder. She shuddered slightly under my touch. "Remember," she said, her voice shaky and weak, "how I told you I took a year off before starting college?" She took a deep breath to try to settle herself before continuing. "I went through a bad spell. Some stuff happened in high school, stuff I'm not proud of." "You don't have to. I was kind of wild in high school. I used to get drunk at parties and do stupid shit. I wish I could tell you it was because I fell in with a bad crowd, but that wouldn't be true. At first it was silly stuff like dancing on tables or sitting on guys' laps, you know, flirting. I guess I liked how they looked at me." She paused to gather up her courage, taking in a breath that fluttered as she exhaled. "Then it became more than flirting. By the time I was a junior, I had lost my virginity to a guy who told me I was beautiful. Then he told everybody that I was easy. After that, there were more guys and even more stories." Her trembling grew to an uncontrollable shake. I wrapped my arms around her and pulled her into me. She didn't protest, but instead turned her face into my sleeve and cried hard. I laid my cheek against her hair and held her while she cried. After a while, the trembling subsided and she took another deep breath. "When I was a senior, they started calling me Nasty Nash. Not to my face, but I heard them. And the sad thing is, it didn't stop me. I'd go to parties and get drunk and wind up in some guy's bed or in the backseat of some piece of shit car. And when they were done, they would just kick me to the curb." She rubbed the top of her arm, kneading it the way Jeremy sometimes rubs his knuckles when he's upset. She paused again to calm her trembling voice before going on. "Then, on the night of my graduation, I got messed up at a party. Somebody put something in my drink. I woke up the next morning in the back seat of my car out in the middle of a bean field. I didn't remember a thing. Nothing. I hurt. I knew that I'd been raped, but I didn't know who did it or how many there were. The police found a drug called Rohypnol in my system. It's a date rape drug. It makes it so that you can't fight back, and then it wipes out your memory. Nobody else remembered anything either. No one from the party would say how I left, or who I was with. I don't think they believed me when I said I was raped. A week later, someone emailed a picture from a phony email account. Lila started to shake again, and her breathing turned shallow. She gripped my arm as if to steady herself. It was a picture of me, and there were two guys. Their images were scrambled, and She broke down, crying uncontrollably. I wanted to say something to take the pain away, a task that I knew I could not achieve. "You don't have to say any more," I said. "It doesn't matter to me." She wiped her tears on her sleeve and said, "I have to show you something." She nervously reached up, gripped the oversized collar of her sweatshirt and pulled it down, exposing 6 thin scars, straight striations from a razor blade cutting across her shoulder. She brushed her fingers over the scars to draw my attention to them, and she lowered her head into the back of the couch as if to turn her face as far away from me as she could. "That year I took off before starting college, I spent that time in therapy. You see, Joe," she said, her lips twitching upward into a frightened smile, "I have issues." I brushed my cheek against the soft tickle of her hair. Then I wrapped one arm around her waist, the other under her tucked-up knees, and lifted her off the couch. I walked her to her bedroom, laid her in her bed, rolled a comforter up to her shoulders, and bent down and kissed her cheek, which creased with a slight smile. "I'm not afraid of issues," I said, letting the words settle on her before I stood up to leave, although leaving was the last thing I wanted to do. That's when I heard her say, in a voice barely loud enough to reach me, "I don't want to be alone." I swallowed my surprise, hesitating only a moment before walking around to the other side of the bed. I slipped off my shoes, lay down in the bed, and gently wrapped my arm around Lila. She squeezed my hand, pulling it up to her chest, holding it like she would hold a teddy bear. I lay behind her, breathing in her scent, savoring the faint beating of her heart against my fingertips, curling my body around her body. And although my presence in her bed came about because of her pain and sadness, it filled me with an odd sense of happiness, a sense of belonging, a feeling I had never felt before, a feeling so exquisite that it bordered on agony. I reveled in that feeling until I fell asleep. Chapter 29. I woke the next morning to the sound of a hairdryer whirring in Lila's bathroom. I was still in her bed, still wearing my khakis and shirt, still not sure where things stood between us. I sat up, checked the corners of my mouth for drool, climbed out of her bed, and followed the scent of fresh coffee brewing. Before I got to her kitchen, I stopped in front of a framed poster to check my appearance in its glass. Tufts of hair stuck out of my head in all directions, like I'd been cowlicked by a drunken heifer. I splashed some water from the kitchen faucet onto my bedhead to tame my hair a bit, just as Lila came out of the bathroom. "I'm sorry," she said. "Did I wake you?" She had changed into another oversized jersey and a pair of silky pink pajama bottoms. "Not at all," I said. "Did you sleep okay?" "I slept great," she said. She walked up to me, put one hand on my cheek, raised up on her tiptoes, and kissed my lips. A soft, slow, warm kiss, so tender it hurt. When she finished, she eased back a couple steps, looked into my eyes, and said, "Thank you." Before I could say a word, she turned around to the cupboard, casually picking up 2 coffee mugs. She handed one to me and twirled the other on her finger as we waited for the coffee maker to finish its magic. Could she tell that the taste of her kiss still lingered on my lips? That my cheek tingled where her fingers had touched it? That the scent of her skin pulled me toward her like gravity? She seemed unaffected by the current that had left me paralyzed. The coffee maker dinged its success, and I filled our mugs, first hers, then mine. So what's for breakfast? I said.
Ah, breakfast, she said. Here at Shea Lila, we have a terrific breakfast menu.
The specialty du jour is Cheerios. Or I could have the chef whip up an order of Special K.
What? No Panakokens?
I asked. And if you want milk with your Cheerios, you're going to have to run to the store and get some.
Do you have an egg?
I asked. I have a couple of them, but no bacon or sausage to go with them.
Bring your eggs to my place, I said. I'll whip us up some pancakes.
Lila grabbed the eggs from the fridge and followed me to my apartment. As I got the mixing bowl and ingredients out of the cupboard, she went to the coffee table where the Carl Iverson project lay sorted into piles.
So, who do we track down next?
Lila said as she flipped through the piles, not looking at anything in particular.
I think we should track down the bad guy, I said.
And who's that?
I don't know, I said,
as I measured pancake mix into a bowl.
When I look at that stuff, my brain hurts.
Well, we know Crystal died sometime between when she left school with Andrew Fisher and when the fire department got there. And we know that the diary entries were about a stolen car and not about Carl seeing Crystal and Andy Fisher in the alley. So whoever was blackmailing Crystal had to know about them crashing the GTO.
That has to be a pretty short list.
Andrew knew, of course, she said.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have told us about it if he was the one in the diary.
Besides, the diary suggests that someone else figured it out.
Daddy Doug ran the car lot, she said. Maybe he didn't buy the whole car theft hoax.
It's also possible that Andrew bragged to someone. Maybe let it slip that he and Crystal were the ones that crashed into that cop car. I mean, if I pulled a stunt like that, I would have been itching to tell my buddies. He'd have been king shit at school.
Nah, I don't buy the coincidence.
Yeah, me neither, I said.
There's got to be something in these piles that points the way.
There is, I said.
There is?
She leaned forward on the couch.
Sure, we just got to solve the code.
Very funny, she said. A knock at the door interrupted our conversation, and I turned the heat down on the pancakes. My first thought was that the slob from the night before, or one of his friends, had tracked me down. I pulled a flashlight from the kitchen drawer. Holding it in my right hand, I planted my foot behind the door, giving it 6 inches of leeway. Lila looked at me as if I had lost my mind. I hadn't told her about ripping into that guy at the bar, or about the two friends that charged after me. I opened the door to find Jeremy in the hall.
Hey, buddy, what?
I let the door swing wider and saw my mother around the side.
Mom?
Hi, Joey, she said, giving Jeremy a light shove through the door. I need you to watch Jeremy for a couple days. She made a slight movement, as if turning to leave, but stopped when she saw Lila sitting on my couch, wearing what looked to be pajamas.
Mom, you can't just show up here.
Now I get it, she said. I see what's going on. Lila stood up to greet my mother.
You're shacking up with little Miss Thing here, leaving your brother and me to fend for ourselves.
Lila wilted back onto the couch. I grabbed my mother, who was halfway into the apartment, and forced her back into the hallway, shutting the door behind us.
Where do you come off? I started.
I'm your mother.
That doesn't give you the right to insult my friend.
Friend? Is that what they call him these days?
She lives next door, and I don't owe you an explanation.
Fine, she shrugged. You do whatever you want, but I need you to watch Jeremy. You can't just show up here and drop him off like this. He's not an old shoe you can toss around.
That's what you get for not taking my calls, she said, turning to leave.
Where are you going?
We're heading to Treasure Island Casino, she said.
We?
She hesitated.
Larry and me.
She headed down the stairs before I could chew her out for still being with that asshole.
I'll be back on Sunday, she hollered over her shoulder.
I took a deep breath to calm down, and then went back into the apartment with a smile, for Jeremy's sake. I finished making pancakes for all three of us, and we ate them in the living room. Lila joked with Jeremy, calling me Jeeves the butler as I served their breakfasts. Although the thought of my mother dumping Jeremy off without warning pissed me off, I couldn't deny the joy of having him here, sitting with Lila and me, especially after the guilt trip of the play. I used to roll my eyes when people told me they were homesick. The thought of missing my mother's dank apartment was as incomprehensible as driving a nail through my ankle for the fun of it. But that morning,
As I watched Jeremy laughing with Lila, calling me Jeeves, eating my pancakes, I realized that a large part of me was homesick. Not for the apartment, but for my brother. After breakfast, Lila went to her apartment to retrieve her laptop to do some homework. I didn't have any DVDs or even a checkerboard, so Jeremy and I played Go Fish with a modified deck of playing cards, sitting on the couch, using the cushion between us as a tabletop. At one point, Lila was tapping away on her computer with the speed of a concert pianist. Jeremy stopped playing cards to watch her, seemingly mesmerized by the flutter of keystrokes. After a few minutes, Lila looked up from her keyboard and stopped typing. "Maybe I think you're a good typer, Lila," he said. Lila smiled at Jeremy. "Why, thank you. It's a very sweet thing to say. Do you know how to type?" "Maybe I took a keyboarding class with Mr. Warner," Jeremy said. "Do you like typing?" she asked. "I think Mr. Warner was funny." Jeremy smiled a big smile. "Maybe Mr. Warner made me type, 'The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog.'" Jeremy laughed, and Lila laughed, which made me laugh. "That's right," Lila said. "That's what you have to type. 'The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog.'" Jeremy laughed even harder when Lila said it. Lila went back to work on her laptop, and Jeremy returned to our game of Go Fish, asking for the same card over and over until I would draw it from the deck. Then he would go to the next card and do the same. After a few minutes, Lila stopped typing, her head snapping up like she had been bitten by a bug or hit square in the face by an epiphany. "It has every letter of the alphabet in it," she said. "What has what?" I said. "The quick brown fox jumps over the lazy dog. They use that sentence in keyboarding class because it has every letter of the alphabet in it."
"Yeah?" I said.
"Crystal Hagen started using her code in September 1980, her freshman year of high school, when she was taking a typing class with Andy Fisher."
"You don't think..." I said.
Lila pulled out a notepad and wrote the sentence down, crossing out the second time that a letter would appear. Then she put a number under each letter. I found Crystal's diary and handed Lila the first page of code that I came to, September 28th. Lila started replacing the numbers with letters. "D, J, F, O."
I shrugged my shoulders. Another dead end, I thought.
"U, N, D, M."
I sat up a little straighter, spotting at least one complete word.
"Y, G, L, A, S, S, E, S." "DJ found my glasses," she yelled, thrusting her notes at me. "It says DJ found my glasses. We did it. Jeremy, we did it. Jeremy, you solved the code." She jumped to her feet and grabbed Jeremy's hands, pulling him off the couch. "You solved the code, Jeremy." She jumped up and down, which caused Jeremy to jump up and down, laughing, not knowing why he was excited.
"Who is DJ?" I said.
Lila stopped jumping, and we both reached into the file box at the same time, pulling out transcripts. She grabbed the transcript with Douglas Lockwood's testimony, and I grabbed Danny's. At the beginning of each witness's testimony, they were asked to give their full name, date of birth, and the spelling of their last name. I frantically flipped through the pages until I found Danny's direct examination. "Daniel William Lockwood," I read. I closed my transcript and looked at Lila. "His middle name's William. It's not Danny," I said.
"Douglas Joseph Lockwood," she said, her face beaming, barely able to contain her excitement.
We looked at each other, trying to grasp the enormity of what we had just learned. Crystal Hagen's stepfather had the initials DJ. DJ is the person who found Crystal Hagen's glasses. The person who found Crystal's glasses was forcing her to have sex. And the person forcing her to have sex was the person who killed her. It was simple deduction. We have found our murderer. Chapter 30. Because we needed to take care of Jeremy, Lila and I waited until Monday before we took our information to the police. In the meantime, the three of us celebrated our own little Thanksgiving, complete with mashed potatoes, cranberries, pumpkin pie, and Cornish game hens, which we told Jeremy were mini turkeys.
It was probably the best Thanksgiving he or I had ever experienced. By Sunday evening, Mom had run out of money at the casino and came to pick up Jeremy. I could tell that he didn't want to go. He sat on my couch ignoring our mother until she finally turned stern and ordered him to stand up. After they left, Lila and I organized the diary notes and the transcript pages that we would take to the police the next day after class. We were barely able to contain our excitement. The Minneapolis Police Department's Homicide Division has an office at Minneapolis City Hall, an old castle-like building in the heart of the city. Ornate archways gave the building's entrance a brief taste of classic Richardsonian architecture, before dissolving into corridors more reminiscent of a Roman bathhouse than Romanesque revival. 5-foot marble sheets lined the walls. Above that, someone had painted the plaster a color that seemed to combine fuchsia with tomato soup. The hallway ran the length of the block, turned left, and ran another half block or so before passing room 108, the office of the Homicide Division. Lila and I gave our names to a receptionist who sat behind bulletproof glass, then we took a seat to wait. After about 20 minutes, a man entered the waiting area, a Glock 9mm on his right hip, and a badge clipped to his belt on the left. He was tall, with a thick chest and biceps like he pumped iron in a prison yard. But he had compassionate eyes that softened his tough appearance and a gentle voice, a notch or two softer than I expected. Lila and I were the only two people in the waiting area. "Joe? Lila?" he asked, extending his hand. We each shook it in turn. "Yes, sir," I said. "I'm Detective Max Rupert," he said. "I was told you have information on a homicide case." "Yes, sir," I said. "It's about the murder of Crystal Hagen." Detective Rupert looked away as if reading names from a list in his head. "That name doesn't ring a bell." "She was killed back in 1980, Lila said. Rupert blinked hard a couple times, cocking his head to the side like a dog hearing an unexpected sound. "Did you say 1980? "I know you think we're a couple of crackpots, but just give us 2 minutes of your time. If you think we're full of crap after 2 minutes, we'll leave. But if we make sense, even a little bit, then there may be a murderer running free." Rupert looked at his watch, sighed, and gave a flick of his fingers, waving us to come with him. We walked through a room full of cubicles and turned into a room with a simple metal table and 4 wooden chairs. Lila and I sat on one side of the table and opened up our red rope folder.
2 minutes, Rupert said, pointing at his watch. Go.
I didn't think he would take me literally about the 2 minutes. And it flustered me at first. I gathered my thoughts and began. In October of 1980, a 14-year-old girl named Crystal Hagen was raped and murdered. Her body was burned in a tool shed belonging to her next-door neighbor Carl Iverson, who was convicted for her murder. One of the key pieces of evidence was a diary. I pointed at the red rope folder, and Lila pulled the diary out. "This is Crystal's diary," Lila said, laying her hand upon the pages. The prosecutor used certain passages from the diary to suggest that Carl Iverson was stalking Crystal and forcing her to have sex with him. He used those diary entries to convict Iverson, but there were a few coded lines in the diary. Lila opened the diary to the first coded message.
"Where'd you get that?"
Rupert picked up the diary pages and flipped through them.
"See these numbers?"
He pointed to a number stamped on the bottom of each page.
"These pages are Bates stamped," he said. "This is evidence in a case."
"That's what I'm telling you," I said. "We got them from Iverson's attorney. They're from his trial." "Look at this code," Lila said, showing Rupert the pages with the code. In September of 1980, Crystal started writing in code. Not a lot, just every now and again. They never deciphered the code for the trial. Rupert read through the diary for a bit, lingering on the pages with coded entries.
"Okay. And?"
he said.
"And..."
I looked at Lila.
"We broke the code. Well, actually, she broke the code."
I pointed at Lila, who pulled a page from her folder with all of the coded entries listed, followed by the decoded text. She slid the paper in front of Detective Rupert. I watched his eyes as he read the messages that Crystal Hagen had worked so hard to keep hidden. "September 21st. Terrible day today. Can't find my glasses. I am freaking out. This is very, very bad. September 28th. DJ found my glasses. If I don't do what he wants, he'll tell everyone. He'll ruin my life.
September 30th. I did DJ with my hand. I hate him. I feel sick. October 8th. DJ won't give my glasses back. He keeps threatening me. He wants me to use my mouth. October 9th. I gave DJ what he wanted. He forced me. I want to kill myself. I want to kill him. October 17th. DJ made me do it again. He was rough. It hurt. October 29th. It's rape. DJ is raping me. Mrs. Tate said so. She said that the age difference means he'll go to prison for sure. It stops today. I am so happy.
What's this about lost glasses? Rupert asked.
I explained our conversation with Andrew Fisher about how he and Crystal stole the car, wrecked it, and left behind proof of their deed in the form of the lens from Crystal's glasses. You see, I said, whoever found those glasses must have known about the stolen car and the lens. He knew he had something to hold over her, leverage to make her, you know, comply.
Rupert leaned back in his chair, looking up at the ceiling. So this Carl guy gets convicted based, in part, on this diary?
Yes, I said. The prosecutor told the jury that Iverson caught Crystal in a compromising position and was using that to force Crystal to have sex with him. Lila added, without breaking the code, there would be no way to know for sure who was raping her.
Do you have an idea who DJ is?
He asked. It's the girl's stepfather, Lila said. His name is Douglas Joseph Lockwood.
And you think it's him, because his name is Douglas Joseph?
Rupert said.
That, I said, and the fact that he managed the car lot where Crystal stole the car, so he would have known about the lens.
The cops investigating the theft must have mentioned it when they came by the lot. We also have these pictures, Lila said, and pulled out the picture showing the closed blind and the second one that showed someone peeking out the window when no one should have been in the house. Rupert studied the pictures, pulling a magnifying glass out of a drawer to look closer at each. Then he put the pictures down on the table, put his hands together, fingertip to fingertip, and tapped them as he spoke.
Do you know which prison Iverson is in? He asked.
He's not in prison, I said. He's dying of cancer, so they paroled him to the nursing home in Richfield.
So you are not trying to get this guy out of prison?
Mr. Rupert, I said. Carl Iverson's going to be dead in a matter of weeks. I'd like to clear his name before he dies.
It doesn't work like that, Rupert said. I don't know you. I don't know this case. You walk in here with the story of a diary and a code, and you want me to absolve this Iverson guy. I'm not the Pope. Someone's got